Air.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Paul Klebnikov, is the Mario Puzo of post-communist Russia. We puzzle a lot about what went wrong after Perestroika. Was it the vodka? Was it oligarchy? Was it post-Marxist blues? Was it the West's fault? The Paul Klebnikov answer is, it's the gangsterism, stupid. It's crony capitalism that's built partly on Al Capone's Chicago model, partly on African kleptocracy. Russia, he writes, is a place where a secret police state has been privatized. One Russian jewelry dealer calls it a mafioso economy where state institutions merge with criminal structures, where there are no normal laws and no market, only corrupt officials, bribes, essential anarchy. A few men have gotten absurdly rich while industrial output, social structures, and civil society are withering on the vine. Life expectancy has dropped to third world levels. Connection listeners, Paul Klebnikov has written an angry case study of Russian oligarchy in the person of Boris Berezovsky, whom he calls godfather of the Kremlin. No, those oligarchs are not our robber barons. They're not captains of industry, captains of anything, in fact, but crime. They're not capitalists either, and they weren't necessary. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is at war with the oligarchs, as Boris Yeltsin was not, but is oligarchy over? Make the Godfather connection with Paul Klebnikov this hour at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Paul Klebnikov, welcome. This is an angry and very chilling book about Berezovsky and his ilk. I wish you'd start with the man himself, and you've talked to him a lot, even though he sued you and Forbes magazine for what you've written. Introduce him.
Well, this is a man who's, I guess, now 55 years old. Until about 10 years ago, he worked as a scientist, as a mathematician, quite an eminent one. He was a member of the Academy of Sciences, which is the elite institution, scientific institution in the former Soviet Union. And then he switched to being a car dealer, and he made a deal with Russia's version of General Motors, their largest car manufacturer, an enormous company on the Volga, to sell him cars below production cost, which he then promptly resold at twice the value. It was a corrupt deal. And it was just the beginning of his ascent. That was how he made his first money. Then he used his mob ties to protect his businesses and moved on into more and more businesses, and eventually moved into politics. Having privatized a lot of the Russian economy, he then ended up privatizing the state. He got very close to Yeltsin. He published Yeltsin's book, gave Yeltsin a big advance, which was unjustified by the sales of that particular book, of Yeltsin's memoirs, and then became very, very friendly, the top businessman within the Yeltsin circle and sort of the financial patron of the Yeltsin family, and ended up controlling the government and, in fact, ensuring the rise and fall of governments, the dismissal of prime ministers, the appointments of finance ministers, police chiefs, etc., and remains quite powerful to this day.
The memoir price reminds one of Rupert Murdoch, except he never stopped moving in on oil deals, on power, on the eventual... Really, I mean, he ushered Yeltsin out and Putin in a fashion, did he not?
Yes, he did indeed. So after having masterminded Yeltsin's re-election in 1996, which was a massively corrupt election, which under any normal democracy would have been deemed invalid because of the huge violations of financing and other types of violations, the involvement of state structures in re-electing Yeltsin and so on and so forth. Berezovsky was the brains behind that re-election back in 1996. And then when the elections of 2000 came along, clearly Yeltsin could not be elected for a third term. He was already much too infirm. Berezovsky played a key role in appointing Putin, as Vladimir Putin, as Yeltsin's heir, and thought that this way he was going to get a guarantee for the continuing prosperity of his own personal business empire.
There's a lot of this stuff, I must say, that we heard about generally, but I hadn't seen in this context. I mean, the gang wars open shootouts in which almost anybody was fair game in sort of street fighting a la Chicago, except more so. Also, the Chechen involvement as sort of they being the shock troops in the gang warfare. But there was also an assassination attempt on Berezovsky with a car bomb that killed his driver.
Yes, the driver was decapitated in front of his eyes.
Explain this. This is much more like a New York gang warfare than what we think of as capitalism, much less sort of
Russian
reform.
Yes, and in fact, this is the thing that makes Russia unique in a sense. When you think about organized crime and gangsters in American history, you think about people who are basically on the periphery of both the economy and the political system. I mean, at the most, you have some gangsters corrupting local political bosses, but you never have gangsters rising up to determine fates of the nation itself. And what was interesting about Russia in the Yeltsin era is that you had a lot of people who passed through this whole gangster stage to become the arbitrators of national politics. And specifically, what's interesting about Berezovsky's story is the distant past. Now he's a man who fashions himself as a statesman, as a humanitarian, as a political leader, as a philosopher, etc. But if you go back to the past, to 92, 93, 94, just when the Russian market was starting out, he traveled an extremely blood-soaked path to riches. In fact, a uniquely blood-soaked path among Russia's oligarchs. And he became involved. The car industry was one of the chief battlegrounds between rival gangs who were controlling different businesses. And Berezovsky became involved in that. He was his business was at the center of it. And
this is I must say it's hard to absorb, particularly because we on this program we've talked to a lot of people, historians, most recently I think Steve Cohen, but about what went wrong. But we've talked over the years what happened in the Gaidar economic reforms, the cold shower and the shock therapy and all of this stuff. It's hard to believe that what was really, although I urge you to sort of persuade us, that what was really happening here was kind of the Gotti wars for control of the old communist state.
Well, you said it very well in your introduction, which is that when governmental authority collapsed and the normal sort of above-ground economy collapsed and the government couldn't pay its policemen, it couldn't pay its judges, it couldn't pay its ministers, etc., you basically developed a system of complete anarchy, of complete lawlessness. And in a condition of anarchy and lawlessness, it's the rule of the jungle, and the strongest survive. And without courts of law, functioning courts of law, or in fact an effective legal system, it's force that determines the issue at the end of the day in many cases. And Berezovsky's career proved that. And he managed to pass through that stage. And very successfully, a lot of his rivals in the market went down, died, were arrested, went bankrupt, etc. He emerged on top.
What was his grip on the Chechen death squads? I mean, he didn't come out of that world. He was a scientist. He was a mathematician.
Well, the Chechen story in Moscow is quite interesting. They began forming probably the first really powerful organized crime group in Russia and specifically in Moscow back in the 1980s. And because they were an oppressed national minority and because of their traditions of extreme clannishness, of being absolutely closed to any outsiders and never betraying each other, either to the police or to other outsiders, they became an extremely effective organized crime group. And in fact, the whole Chechen community sort of united together and
Sicilian,
helped each other
so to speak.
Yes.
I mean, everything we associate with the myth of Sicilians.
Yes, even more united, in a sense. It was a smaller community. I mean, the number of Chechen gangsters in Moscow, even at the height of their power in the early 90s, was about 500 to 1,000 men. But nonetheless, because of their clannishness and also because of their principle of blood vengeance, of vendetta, they were extremely ferocious and completely traumatized both the police, businessmen in Moscow, and all other rival organized crime groups. And these are the people that Berezovsky allied himself with as he was building his auto dealership business. He became Russia's largest auto dealer and decided to rely on the Chechens to protect him. And so he developed very, very good contact with a number of Chechen gangsters and gangster leaders, which then served him later on after he became a politician in the late 90s and was put in charge of negotiating with the independent state of Chechnya, or de facto independent state of Chechnya. And then he had a very interesting career as a kind of channel of ransom payments to Chechen gangs in their kidnapping sprees of foreigners, which is an interesting story in itself. But he's had this very strange, shadowy relationship with the worst elements of Chechen society almost from the beginning of the 1990s.
What in the meantime, was Washington making of all of this? And what was the sort of, how did the Washington Clinton Strobe Talbot level wrestling with the Russian mystery make of the mafia rule?
Well, you had the top officials of the FBI arriving in Moscow in 1993-94 when it became apparent that the Russian mafia here, the quote-unquote Russian mafia here in the United States, was starting to pose a real problem and had received a huge boost with what was going on in Russia, and that they sort of entered onto a whole new level of activity here in the U.S. So the FBI and the United States government became concerned with Russian organized crime, so they set up a cooperative agreement with the Russian police, etc. So you had a few sort of press conferences where misgivings were voiced about the rule of crime and anarchy in Russia. But the overall policy of the Clinton administration, quite mistakenly, was to ignore that and brush it under the rug, pretend that it was just an unpleasant peripheral fact, just as it was in United States history, and that, in fact, the real core the really important thing going on in Russia was, quote-unquote, market reforms and the development of democracy. And it was only in 1998, after the whole Russian economy collapsed and the ruble was devalued and American and Western banks lost tens of billions of dollars on the collapse of the Russian ruble, that suddenly people in Washington really started talking seriously about the fact that the system was fatally flawed, and it was flawed by its essential criminality.
I wonder if, you know, even in hindsight, we would have known how to handle it differently if we recognized that.
I think so. I think it's a question of to what extent you're cynical in your foreign policy. It's a question of to what extent are you willing to overlook the faults of a person that you want to support because they give you support in your own foreign policy aims, etc. It's a trade-off, of course. But in my opinion, certainly the United States' experience with Russia has proven to be unbelievably short-sighted.
Paul, stand by and catch your breath. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about the godfather of the Kremlin, Boris Berezovsky, with the writer from Forbes magazine, Paul Klebnikov. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. In the second hour of The Connection, if computers were cars, we'd never get out of the garage.
By the Oligarchy, with Paul Klebnikov, whose book on Boris Berezovsky is called Godfather of the Kremlin. We're joined also by Chrystia Freeland, who's the deputy editor of the Toronto Globe and Mail. Her book is called Sail of the Century, Russia's Wild Ride from Communism to Capitalism. Chrystia Freeland, I mean, you remind us that it wasn't just Berezovsky. There were others, too. Some of them are in exile. Some of them are in deep trouble. You've just talked with Putin, President Putin, among others, about them. How does it stand in your view?
Well, I think some, something very interesting has been happening with the oligarchs since Putin became president. On the one hand, for the first time, the Kremlin has really declared war on the oligarchs. And the really interesting thing about interviewing Putin a couple of weeks ago was that one of the things he spoke about with the greatest passion was saying, you know, I am going to rebuild the power of the state. The oligarchs will no longer be able to dictate to the Kremlin. I am going to show them that I am the boss. On the other hand, many of the oligarchs are richer today than they've ever been. And that's because during the Yeltsin era, they managed to get a hold of Russia's oil and other natural resources. With the high price of oil, they're just rolling in money.
Is there any going back?
Going back to where? To Russia?
Well, no. Going back to state control of natural resources.
Not yet.
Especially oil.
Not yet.
Will there be?
If I had to make a bet, I would predict not. I think that the opening up the whole Pandora's box of ownership, raising questions about the legitimacy of private property and so forth, is such a terrifying step that I don't think Putin is going to go so far. What he has done is over the spring and summer to sort of fire a few shots across the bows of the oligarchs and just warn them that if they didn't bow down to his rule, if they didn't agree to the new rules of the game he was establishing, their assets might be in jeopardy. And that happened generally in fairly indirect ways. So the oligarchs found themselves suddenly having 1,000 visits from the tax inspector in a month. The fire inspectors would come. A few prosecutors regionally started opening cases questioning the legitimacy of ownership of particular assets. But for those oligarchs who have de facto done a deal with Putin, a deal basically agreeing not to challenge his political control of the country, I think they're sitting pretty right now.
The giveaway of the gas and oil was part of the swindle that by which Yeltsin was reelected in 96, as Paul Klebnikov was saying. The so-called Magnificent Seven, who stood by him and got the loot. How many of them are still there, Paul Klebnikov? And also fill us in on why Berezovsky, for the moment at least, and Vladimir Guzinski can't go back.
Well, I think Christia is absolutely right that a lot of them have been have gotten wealthier than ever, but a lot of the earlier generation of oligarchs have disappeared, and the reason is quite simple: that for the vast majority of these men are terrible businessmen. If they had to function in a free market, in a genuinely free market, they would fail. And so as soon as the state decides to cut off its massive subsidies or its tax allowances to them, et cetera, a lot of them go under. And in fact, Alexander Smolensky went under. Several bankers of the seven bankers went under. I think Christy is also right that a lot of the moves that Putin made, he really doesn't have to go and say, well, the shareholders of these big oil companies got their shares illegally. All he has to do is to basically cut off the state subsidies to them and cut off the special deals by which they managed to acquire their wealth. And this is very much the case with Berezovsky. It's certainly the case with Vladimir Guzinski. There's a very simple way: if the state wanted to take back some of their prime properties of Russia, there's a very simple way you could do it by law without nationalization or confiscation, which is simply allow the bankruptcy courts to function. A lot of these people are hopeless debtors. And they've looted their companies so badly that they have no ability to climb out of the hole. That's certainly true for the people who made their money financially. But there are people, if you follow that path, which I think Putin to a certain extent has done, then you're weeding out the ones who are real businessmen, such as the oil managers, some of the oil managers, who genuinely want to grow their companies, and therefore will will serve Russia in the future. And the ones who are just fly by night people who want to take as much out of as much cash flow out of a given company as they can and stash it in the West will go under.
We're talking about the looting of Russia, gangster rule in the Yeltsin era, most especially, with Paul Klebnikov, whose book on Boris Berezovsky is called Godfather of the Kremlin. Also with Christian Freeland in Toronto. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Paul is calling from Plattsburgh, New York.
Hello.
Hello, Paul. Welcome.
How are you?
Good.
I'm reading Big Trouble by J. Anthony Lucas, and this is about the West where miners were convicted, or they tried to convict miners of murdering a governor or former governor.
In the good old USA, long ago, yes.
Yes, that's right. And I don't see, I think this is a little disingenuous to say how terrible what's going on in Russia is, because the United States has been backing this for all along.
So?
I think what's upset everybody is that the natural looting, they say, well, here's all this, all the natural resources, all the things that are to be developed. And there's been hardly a word of criticism, really, about the poverty, corruption, murder, AIDS, prostitution, all the wonderful things that the dismantling of the social system. There's hardly been much mention of that. What's the United States seems to be complaining about is they're not getting their fair share cut. They expected to loot that country the way they do in all over.
Paul, I wonder, yeah. You know, what is the Western hand here, both in not necessarily looting, as Paul questions from Plattsburgh, but, I mean, in the question of accepting the ideology and reframing, you know, framing the questions away from all of your evidence in our general view of Russia?
Yes. Is this a question to me? I mean, if
yeah.
I'd like to answer that. I think the Western role has been one of tremendous moral support throughout the 90s, when this whole corrupt gangster system was developing, this huge gangster economy. American and Western officials would arrive continually from the West and pat people on the back and appear on television saying, you're doing a good job, you're going in the right direction, stay the course. Reform and democracy is always difficult to construct, but you're very heroic in what you're doing. So tremendous moral support, and also enormous financial support through the IMF specifically, as well as through other U.S. taxpayer-funded organizations. Billions and billions and billions of dollars were sent to Russia, much of which was misappropriated, which ended up as essentially payoffs to the political class ruling Russia. It's like sending President Mobutu of Zaire $1 billion, and you have no illusions that it's going to get to the rank and file Zairean, but you're certainly paying off Mobutu to stay loyal to U.S. policy, and so on and so forth. And that's what was happening in Russia. So the collusion of Western governments in the creation of this monstrous system was in fact quite significant. And I think that is something that's going to haunt the West, because it was a golden opportunity that was allowed to slip. When you think about it, when communism fell in 1991, Russia was almost a blank slate ideologically. Communism had been discredited. There was nothing else that was arising to take its place. So Russians wanted to become a Western country with a Western economy, a Western style of government, etc. And all these government policies were instated in Russia with that justification, saying we are building a Western style economy and society and politics. And of course, it turned out so monstrous that it discredited the concept in Russian eyes.
Christian Freeland, I just wonder if you agree with that picture of collusion by the West, including, you know, all the academic worthies who went over and blessed what they were doing.
Largely, I do. I mean, I think that what we have to remember when thinking about what was going on in the early and mid-90s in Russia and in the world in general is it was a real moment of capitalist triumphalism. This is a time when people were writing books with titles like The End of History. And there was a real sense that the collapse of communism in Russia meant that the triumph of capitalism was inevitable. I think that was a sense shared by the Western academics and the Western government officials going into Russia, and that was certainly the view of the group of Western-oriented, radically pro-market economists known as the Young Reformers, who were guiding the change and who actually were the men who created the oligarchs in many ways. They were so convinced that state ownership was bad and that private ownership, by definition, in any form, was virtuous, that even if private ownership meant a giveaway of Russia's natural assets to six or seven men, they were somehow convinced that magically, over a few decades or over a few years, these robber barons would become virtuous, efficient, productive capitalists.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255 joins the It's the Gangsterism Stupid analysis of modern Russia. 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is on the line.
Yes, your guest was right to bring up Mobutu, because I was going to comment that this is exactly how we've behaved with any, say, South American dictatorship, that all they had to do was claim that they were anti-communist and make some obeisance toward capitalism, and then, you know, we didn't care if they dropped people into the sea. We would, you know, be very nice to them. But the thing I wanted to ask was, do you think that to any extent, that some of this might have come about because, at least somewhere deep in the back of people's minds, this is what they were taught capitalism was like? You know, that it seems very much like a Soviet-era caricature of capitalism.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I kept getting the feeling when I interviewed all these people, including Berezovsky and government officials and all the young reformers, the Democrats, they kept talking in this strange terminology that I finally realized was an echo of what I'd heard in my college courses of Marxism-Leninism. For instance, Berezovsky kept talking about the primary accumulation of capital, you know, one of these classic phrases out of Das Kapital of Karl Marx. And he loved the primary accumulation of capital. He kept saying, what it involves is the privatization of profits of companies, of state-owned companies. Even before you privatize them per se, you privatize their profits by siphoning off their cash flow through a variety of corrupt deals. And, you know, you kept getting this. I think you're absolutely on the mark there. Everybody was educated in the Soviet educational system, which, after all, was a very sophisticated system, and a lot of the concepts about capitalism stayed with them subliminally.
I'd love to hear this. Wait, just to say, I want to hear the sound of Berezovsky. What would he? You talked with him. What was his take? What was his line? What's his view of himself? What do you think he was doing?
His view of himself is that he fashioned himself like a J.P. Morgan or a Rockefeller, except that he believed that it all started with this kind of primitive power grab, where you use whatever means necessary to grab what you can, accumulate your primary capital, and then you move on to control the government. And so another one of his classic lines is, he says, the rule of the people for democracy, the rule of the people is an abstract conception. More precisely, government should serve the interests of capital, of big business. But he uses the word capital. So clearly he sees himself as this kind of mirror image of some kind of heroic American industrialist of the 19th century. And of course, it's a completely perverted picture.
Christia Freeland.
Yeah, no, just in replying to the caller, in 1998, right after the ruble crash, when things in Russia were looking truly dire, I spoke to a bunch of small businessmen at one of the big Moscow markets, and one of them put the situation to me this way. He said, "What we've realized is that everything Marx told us about communism was false, but everything he taught us about capitalism was true." So I think that Russians do really feel as if they've built the kind of evil capitalism with a small group of grasping, nasty overlords that Marx described.
Christia, I wonder, who are some of the others that you observed, interviewed, or found interesting?
Well, I think there's another group of oligarchs that Paul has alluded to who behaved somewhat differently from Berezovsky. I would describe them as the oil barons. Men like Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Mikhail Friedman, Vladimir Potanin. And what really distinguished them from a guy like Berezovsky was two things. The first one was, whereas Berezovsky concentrated on making personal connections and developing personal networks, these guys concentrated on getting their hands on assets, particularly the sort of assets that it's hard to screw up. So natural resources, you know, the sorts of things you didn't have to be a genius to run a factory efficiently. You just had to know how to pump the oil out of the ground. The other way in which they were quite different from Berezovsky is they did their best to maintain a low public profile. They tried, although they were quite interested in manipulating the Kremlin and having a powerful political voice, they were savvy enough to realize that they should do that as much as possible behind the scenes, whereas Berezovsky quite early on became enamored of this vision of himself as kingmaker and started to really show off his political power. I think that's part of the reason why the oil barons have fared much better than the more openly political oligarchs like Berezovsky and Gusinski.
What about Gusinski, who's now under arrest?
Well, Gusinski, like Berezovsky, was very much a public player. In some ways, he had less choice because he was on the outside. He wasn't that close to the Kremlin in 1995 when the big giveaway of natural resource assets happened. So his empire was basically a media empire. And if you own a television station, newspapers, and magazines, you have no choice but to be politically engaged. Gusinski, however, was even more politically engaged than he needed to be and wasn't merely a proprietor. He also wanted to be a kingmaker, a puppeteer. And I think that that's the reason why he's been the one who Putin has gone against most fiercely. I think there are real questions, though, about freedom of the press as far as the attack on Gusinski is concerned.
Christian Freeland is our guest with Paul Klebnikov. We're talking about Russia and what's gone wrong and wronger and wronger through the 90s, not just failures of statesmanship or ideology or international financial rescue or market reforms or political restructuring. Paul Klebnikov especially says it's been the rule of gangsters, Capone style. 1-800-423-8255 makes the looting of Russia connection, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Is your computer driving you nuts? In the second hour of The Connection, an expert will agree with you.
Opportunities at Allaire.com.
We're talking about the looting of Russia, gangster rule, mafia rule through most of the 90s with the writers Paul Klebnikov and Christian Freeland. Marshall Goldman joins us, the criminologist who is the associate director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard. Marshall, we've heard so many explanations of Russia over the years, including all these sort of high-level ideological and political matters. What is your general take on the line that it was basically a problem of gangsterism?
Well, it certainly played an important role, but I'd say there were other factors there as well. Part of the difficulty is that no matter what you would have done, after 70 years of communism, having destroyed all the institutions that were part of the market system, it was going to be difficult to make the transition. More than that, the Tsarist government was no great shake, no great market operator, and so that combining the legacy of Tsarism with the terrible legacy of communism meant that you're going to have a difficult time. And part of the problem, and this is kind of implied...
That doesn't really answer my question. I mean, we didn't call it what it was through the 90s.
No. Thought
Yeltsin's the best possibility. This is a kind of democracy. They're learning. I mean, if you take the Klebnikov analysis seriously, we were kidding ourselves. I say we, newspaper readers, but also presidents of the United States, about what the problem was.
Well, you're right. But, you know, part of the difficulty was that Russia was so rich. There was so much to steal. If there was less to steal, it wouldn't have been quite so bad. It doesn't mean that the transition from communism to a market system or democracy is doomed to fail. Poland has done it very nicely. but there was less to steal there, and they had some of the traditions. It was also the case that, you know, here, this Russia was our, Soviet Union was our Cold War enemy, and suddenly to see them embrace the market or say they were going to embrace the market and democracy was so exciting for us that we were willing to turn our back on all the sins that are being discussed here, because nobody wanted to accept the fact that maybe they would fall back into communism.
Where do the oligarchs stand or the next generation of oligarchs stand as a kind of countervailing force against the government, against the excesses that could still bust out all over in a Putin government?
Well, right now they basically have been co-opted, and those who are sticking up above the board, you know, the nails that are sticking up are being hammered down, as in the case of Gusinski. What is also intriguing, and this is kind of after Paul Klebnikov's book has come out, is that you almost feel that Berezovsky himself has become a martyr. He's running around saying we've got to have democracy, while, you know, his cries seem a little specious. At the same time, you do have to say, well, if somebody does stand up and criticize Putin, you've got to give them some support, because Putin is really trying to consolidate everything. What he's done is he's created some new oligarchs, Krista implied this as well, who are just as wild and woolly as Berezovsky was, not so much in terms of violence, but in terms of accumulating. Under Putin, they've been allowed to create a brand new aluminum monopoly. Some of the oil companies, again, are being very strong this way. They really don't seem to be much of a force in opposition, because they realize if they try to fight Putin right now, it may mean that he'll go out after them and destroy them.
Marshall, is there a case to be made for the Gusinskis of the world as he's described as an independent media owner. He was very manipulative.
Right.
He was not our kind of sort of statesman of journalism, but is there a case to be made in his defense?
I would make it now. This is a man who, by the way, threatened to sue me because of, I called him I said he was associated with the mafia, so he's not my favorite person, but he's the only port in that storm right now, and that's what's so terrifying about this whole thing, that you have to embrace people like Gusinski, because if he goes, Putin has a completely free ride. Right now, he still has to worry. He still has to be accountable. The press, the fourth estate, as it were, is the only one that's standing up to him now.
But it's not a fourth estate. That's the whole problem. Paul Klebnikov, are you wary of embracing...
I don't know if I agree with that completely, because I don't think you can build a democracy on the basis of a few powerful men opposed to a powerful president, any more than you can build a market economy on the basis of a few private businessmen dominating an economy. I think Russia's not going to become a democracy until it develops a civic society, and certainly Mr. Gusinski, whatever happens to Mr. Gusinski, is not going to help or hinder the development of the civil society. On the other hand,
what you
can achieve is enforce the rule of law. Whatever rules, whatever laws they have on the books, they should start enforcing them. And one of the main problems with Russia in the 1990s was the fact that the laws were not being enforced. And I think the laws should be enforced starting with the most powerful people. The man on the street in Russia always says, well, you know, they get the small criminals, they get the working man, but the big criminals get off scot-free. And I think that has to be changed.
Well, I'm actually quite concerned about defenses of Putin that start with saying that enforcing the rule of law is what he's doing and that that's fair and good. The problem with the way that Russian capitalism has been created is there are no significant players. There are even no medium-sized businessmen who haven't broken the law. And so if you want to be an authoritarian dictator in Russia, the perfect slogan to choose for yourself is to say, I'm going to enforce the rule of law. What that actually will mean in practice is a carte blanche to go after any political enemy you choose. And in effect, that's what we've seen happening in Russia right now. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about saying, well, as long as these guys actually committed crimes, it's a good thing for the Kremlin to be attacking them. I think we have to really look at whether laws are being enforced selectively or not, and that is what seems to be happening.
I agree completely with Christia. It would be very nice if we could just say you have to obey the law, and Putin says everybody's going to obey the law. But in this case, it's the dictatorship of the law, which is so frightening. And given his background, his associations, his instincts that are really KGB in nature, it's just not going to happen. Grudzinski, I would say, is not the world's ideal citizen. But if you don't have people like Grudzinski standing up and criticizing, you're not going to have anybody doing it. And again, the Russian tradition has always been, Tsarist times as well, you must have a patron in the government. If you don't have a patron in the government, you're destroyed. And that, so you just can't say you've got to have the law. You've got to have people with an interest willing to challenge it. And so far, Grudzinski's the only one on the block doing it.
1-800-423-8255. Paul Klebnikov, be quick, and we'll go to calls again.
All right. I'd like to respond to Christia's point. Yes, almost all businessmen in Russia had to break the law at some point or another. But does that mean then you don't enforce the law at all? I think what you have to do is you go after the most egregious lawbreakers, and specifically the ones who made the most profit by breaking the law most egregiously. And yes, you're going to have to be selective. That's the nature. Unfortunately, Russia is not equipped to be a perfect Western-style democracy at this point. So you're going to have, one way or another, the government is going to have to be selective. And I agree. I haven't said that Putin is acting completely correctly. He's acting with a club instead of with a scalpel here. And at this point, but nonetheless, if one is going to take him at his word, and I think it's too early to say that he's in fact very cynical and not trying to enforce the rule of law. You have to support that. You have to say yes. That's the one thing that's been lacking so far.
1-800
enforcement of law.
1-800-423-8255 makes the looting of Russia connection. Margaret's on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Margaret.
Thank you for this program.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, after listening to you, if the war on Chechnya can be interpreted as a war against the gangster's army.
I wondered about that myself. Paul Klebnikov, what did you mean about that? I mean, does that justify in any way or explain?
That certainly helped public opinion in Russia to justify the war. And certainly the first war was caused by a kind of the final breaking of the patience of the Russian government and the Russian people at the sort of freewheeling anarchy caused by Chechen gangsters in Moscow and other Russian cities. But the current war, I don't think you can say is a war against organized crime in any form. Yes, Chechnya has been a home for kidnapping gangs and drug traffickers and so on and so forth. But I think there are other things at play here.
Let's leave it there because it's a world unto itself, the Chechen war. Pat is on the line. Hello, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I've been going to Russia since 1992, and I was there in 98, October, and I spoke with a young man who was just graduating from school, and I asked him what he wanted to do when he graduated from high school over there, and he I said, do you want to become a lawyer, a doctor, or what? And he said, I only hope I'm good enough to work for the mafia. And he was serious, and he was learning English and French, and I felt very sad, and haven't been back since.
Was this a cowboy adventure, or is it a way to wealth, or what?
It's the only job he could think of working at so he could make some money. Yeah. And I felt very sad to hear that, because I had grown to love the country, and and to hear that, it was quite sad. So
Is there any reason to say, Marshall Goldman or Paul Klebnikov or Christia too, that the kid was right?
I think I'm afraid he was. One of the problems is if you try to start your own business and you become too visible, they hone in on you right away. And it's not just the mafia now; it's also the government. Because of the needless reforms that have to be filled out. And somebody mentioned earlier the visits from the fire inspector, the police inspector, and foreign investors have this same kind of problem. I would take issue with Paul to some extent that everybody has to obey the law. The trouble is the laws are still reflecting some of the old communist era procedures, and so if you follow them, it doesn't mean necessarily that you're doing it the way you would be doing it in Western Europe or the United States. Bankruptcy, for example. The bankruptcy laws are being used to steal companies and to defraud minority stockholders, and this is something Western investors have found as well. So you can't just say it's a simple thing just to follow the laws.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right about that. The legal system is terrible, and in fact, what Putin most needs now is about 1,000 people trained in legal systems and the law to help him sort this whole thing out. But look, just take the simplest laws. Let's start with enforcing the law for murder. It's simple enough. That was a case in which it was blatantly not enforced. You know, every year throughout the 1990s and still today, there were hundreds of top businessmen and politicians, famous people who are being assassinated, the so-called contract killings. And something like 20% of those contract killings are ever solved. Why? Because the police don't know who did it? Of course they know who did it. Would they be able to arrest the people who did it and bring them to court and be able to charge them under the law and win the case in court? Yes, of course they could. But the political will has been absent.
You know, do you think that Putin is going to go after his own men in the interior ministries who've been part of this system?
Well, that's a problem. I agree with you. I think that's a problem. I think he's stated some very high ambitions, some very idealistic conceptions, achievable idealistic conceptions about enforcing the rule of law, but so far has made some bad compromises about it. I think he shouldn't... I think he should be more active and more even-handed about it. But, you know, give the man time. He's only getting his bearings at this point.
Well, what I'm worried about is we're giving him too much time and he's heading in exactly the wrong direction, and particularly in stamping out anybody who criticizes him. That's the worst thing that you can do right now.
And
the amazing thing is that his popularity standing is so high. It's over 70%, and the Russians love it. They also love it when he cracks down on the oligarchs, whether they're good, bad, or indifferent. And that's also rather scary.
Paul Klebnikoff, we're almost out of time. Are you free to go and promote this book in Russia? What do you do if Vladimir Putin embraces you as an enemy of the oligarchs?
I'll have to do my best. It's actually coming out in Russian within the next month. So we'll see how people react to it there.
We'll see how they react to you. I hope your security guards are ready. Paul Klebnikoff, thank you for the book, and thank you for joining us on The Connection. It's called Godfather of the Kremlin. Thanks also to Marshall Goldman, Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard, and to Chrystia Freeland, whose book is called Sale of the Century. She's Deputy Editor of the Toronto Globe and Mail. You can continue the looting of Russia conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by High Ground Incorporated, public relations and marketing for emerging high technology, www.highgroundinc.com.